Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, December 16th, 2022. President Joe Biden talking about the new benefits available to veterans exposed to toxic chemicals. The president was at a National Guard center in Delaware named for his late son, Beau Biden, whose death from brain cancer the president believes could have been from his military service near burn pits in Iraq and Kosovo. The president saying, "I made it real clear to the United States Congress if it didn't pass this damn burn pit bill, I was going to go on holy war, not a joke." Congress not in session today, but before the Senate adjourned Thursday night, it passed a bill authorizing defense programs for the new fiscal year, $858 billion, and also passed a one-week extension of federal government spending to prevent a government shutdown tonight and allow more time for finalizing a full fiscal year omnibus government funding bill. The president of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco seeing at least one more percentage point increase in interest rates before the Fed pauses to assess whether the hikes are doing what they need to do to bring down high inflation. State Department today asked about Twitter owner Elon Musk suspending the accounts of some journalists. And it's been an eventful year in British politics, three prime ministers in the span of 3 months. We'll talk about it with C-SPAN's Parliament producer Peter Knowles. And we begin with President Biden at a town hall meeting with veterans and veteran survivors discussing new health care and disability benefits available under a bill he signed into law in August called the PACT Act. It stands for Promise to Address Comprehensive Toxics. The law helps veterans get screened for exposure to toxins, including Agent Orange used during the Vietnam War, and from burn pits where trash was burned on military bases in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. The law assumes some respiratory illnesses and cancers are connected to those burn pits. The president was at the National Guard and Reserve Center in Newcastle, Delaware, named for his late son, Beau Biden, who was a major in the Delaware National Guard and died of brain cancer in 2015. The president suggesting exposure to the burn pits during his service overseas may have been the cause.
I've been in and out, not as obviously combatant, but in and out of Afghanistan, Iraq, and his areas 38, 39 times. As not as president, only twice as president, but from the time I was a senator, but particularly when I was vice president. And, it was pretty clear to a lot, there was a lot of discussion, as some of you remember, about these burn pits. You all know what a burn pit is? It's a hole between 8 and 10 feet, as high as 12 feet deep. The size of a football field, a great big rectangle. And every damn ugly thing in the world is burned in it. Everything. Everything. Toxic waste, everything. And I'm no doctor, but it's pretty clear a lot of guys and women getting sick. And so, one of the things is these poisonous chemicals, jet fuel. In some places, some other things I won't mention. The toxic smoke, thick with poison, spreading into the air, into the lungs of our troops. And many of them, when they came home, had gone the best trained, fittest warriors in the world, and came home with headaches, numbness, dizziness, cancer. Remember Beau calling and saying, how I collapsed on a run? Well, both father-in-law, as I said, Ronnie Oliver, my friend, is here. So are several members of the Guard who served with Beau in Iraq. This is personal to them, and it's personal to all of us. And it's not unique to me and my family. So many are here today and around the country. Secretary McDonough can tell you we're determined to do something about this. Come hell or high water, and I mean that. I made it real clear to the United States Congress, if they didn't pass this damn burn pit bill, I was going to go on holy war, not a joke. And I want to thank, we had to thank someone for this that helped a great deal, it's not here, John Stewart made a gigantic difference. And Dennis and others and I went to on the Capitol steps with groups, and maybe some of you were part of that. Thank you. And you were there, you stayed there, and you insisted that they vote on it. because some of our friends were not willing to do this. But you insisted.
President Biden at the Beau Biden National Guard and Reserve Center in Newcastle, Delaware. The White House says more than 730,000 veterans have already gotten health screenings under the PACT Act out of an estimated 3.5 million veterans eligible for benefits. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan looking ahead to the next 2 years of the Biden administration's foreign policy objectives in a discussion today hosted by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Jake Sullivan was asked to name two top goals. He pointed to rebuilding the U.S. defense industrial base and transitioning to clean energy.
One of the issues that has been exposed through the war in Ukraine is the defense industrial base and the need to ensure that we have the same kind of diversified resilient supply chain and production capacity for our defense industrial base that we have now tried to build with respect to on the public health side coming out of COVID. Not just us, but our entire allied ecosystem. How do we make sure we're in a position midterm where we can produce the necessary elements to be able to support Ukraine, to be able to deal with contingencies elsewhere in the world? And this is something that, you know, we have inherited that over the course of decades of underinvestment, concentration, consolidation, and a lot of other choices, we are not in the position we need to be in. So that is a big area that I would like to deliver against. And then the second area that is now, you know, though the last 2 years have really exposed where we have more work to do, is we've tended to think about the climate issue here and then sort of the issue of kind of energy affordability and reliability here. These two things have become deeply connected in the last 2 years. How do we actually execute an energy transition that does not break the backs of working people but delivers on our climate goals? That is a really hard thing to do. It requires an enormous amount of coordination, intelligent policy making, effective diplomacy. And so that is another major area that over the course of the next 2 years, we have to work very hard to get right.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a program titled The Biden Foreign Policy at 2 Years. He mentioned the war in Ukraine, Associated Press reporting that Ukraine's capital came under one of the biggest attacks of the war on Friday, as Russia's invading forces fired dozens of missiles across the country, triggering widespread emergency power outages, Ukrainian officials said. Also today, Brittany Griner back home in Arizona after leaving a medical facility in Texas and also posting her first public comments since her release from a Russian prison earlier this month in a prisoner exchange. Brittany Griner writing, "It feels so good to be home. The last 10 months have been a battle at every turn. I dug deep to keep my faith, and it was the love from so many of you that helped keep me going. From the bottom of my heart, thank you to everyone for your help." She also writes, "President Biden, you brought me home, and I know you are committed to bringing Paul Whelan home and all Americans home, too. I will use my platform to do whatever I can to help you." And she says she intends to play professional basketball again. U.S. Senate Thursday night passing the annual Defense Policy and Programs Bill called the NDAA, or National Defense Authorization Act. The vote was 83-11. The House had passed it last week, so the bill now heads to President Biden's desk to be signed into law. It authorizes $858 billion. That's 5% or $45 billion more than the president requested. Ahead of the vote, the Senate Armed Services Committee ranking Republican James Inhofe of Oklahoma spoke on the Senate floor.
The Armed Services Committee agreed almost unanimously to boost the president's President Biden's inadequate defense budget by $45 billion. This additional funding will address record high inflation rates and ensure that we're able to implement the little blue book that we talk about all the time. It's worked very successfully in the past. It'll be working successfully long after I'm gone, too. So additional funding will address record high inflation rates. We are ensured that we'll be able to implement the little blue book the way we have done it in the past. We need to prioritize defense. It's as simple as that. The NDAA addresses the national defense strategy and in concrete ways. We need to get this done, and we're going to get it done, and we're going to get it done this evening. So I encourage all my colleagues to support this year's National Defense Authorization Bill, and let's extend our track record of getting this bill done, and let's show our troops that we love them and that we support them.
Senator James Inhofe, Republican from Oklahoma, ranking member on the Armed Services Committee, Thursday night before the Senate passed the Defense Authorization Bill. Ahead of the vote on final passage, there were a couple of amendments offered to the defense bill. None of those passed. One was from Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, dealing with energy project permitting reform.
We passed a piece of legislation that puts us on a two-path. You can walk and chew gum. You've got to have fossil. Now, if you're doing fossil, which is cleaner, that means carbon capture sequestration, we put billions of dollars in there for that. And on top of that, we put billions of dollars for methane, plugging old wells, abandoned mine lands. We're cleaning up everything. Tremendous. And if you're using the fossil that we use in the United States cleaner and helping our allies around the world, we have been able to help the climate more than it can ever be helped by anything else. As we develop the new technologies of the world, hydrogen, we can make that all day long. We're on the verge of doing something unbelievable. But let me tell you, most of it will be for naught. Because without permitting reform, the United States of America is more litigious than any nation on earth has been developed. Anyone. It takes longer to do anything here. We've got people talking about they've been trying to get permits for 16 years. Canada, average of 3 years. Down to our friends in Australia, down under, it's 2 to 3 years. Us, 5, 7, 10, and more. This is a 10-year path we have. We've appropriated money in this piece of legislation for a 10-year path. A lot of the programs we want to do, whether it's building pipelines, whether it's building new transmission lines to carry the energy that we need, whether it's developing new, cleaner technologies, whether it's carrying pipelines, it's carrying hydrogen and CO2, we have all of this that we need. That's all for, it's not going to happen. And I just can't believe it. And here's the thing I can't believe. All of my Republican friends, and I have worked with them, and I know they're upset in the politics that plays into this, but they're upset about the IRA. We did it through reconciliation. Well, it's the only vehicle we had. The only vehicle we had to do something that was monumental. And we did that. And we did that by working with my colleagues on the other side for the last 5 years. My colleagues on the other side, my Republican friends, have always said, Joe, we have to have more energy. Well, guess what? The IRA is going to put more energy in.
Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, on the Senate floor Thursday night, his amendment to the defense policy bill. Opposing the amendment, Senator Roger Marshall, Republican from Kansas.
Certainly, the chairman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee and I agree on so many common goals when it comes to American energy. We both believe in American energy independence. We believe in affordable, clean energy. We agree that we want to leave this world cleaner, healthier, and safer than we found it. But unfortunately, I oppose his amendment and ask my colleagues to oppose it as well. I'm afraid this amendment will do more harm than good. It'll give the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC as it's known, the power to socialize the cost of a new high voltage transmission lines. That's right, a huge shift of power will go from the states to the federal government. Unelected bureaucrats would have the authority to make electric customers in mostly red states pay to deliver expensive and intermittent energy that fits the green energy dreams of blue states, in many cases causes rural America to pay for urban America's electricity. It would even give federal regulators the authority to make residents of inland states pay for transmission lines that connect offshore wind farms to coastal states such as California, New Jersey, and New York. It would allow these same regulators to make our residents pay for these transmission lines, even if power on those lines would not serve them. And why this transportation of wind and solar electricity fits their social agenda, let me remind everyone, the cost of transporting this electricity is approximately 10 times more than transporting enough clean natural gas to produce an equivalent amount of electricity. We need not only clean energy, We need affordable energy.
Senator Roger Marshall is a Republican from Kansas on the Senate floor Thursday night. The Senate voted down Senator Manchin's amendment. The vote was 47 to 47, short of the 60 votes needed for passage. It was not a party line vote. 7 Republicans voted yes, 10 Democrats voted no. As for why the amendment came up, TheHill.com reports that the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer had promised Senator Manchin he would take up the legislation to speed the process for approving new U.S. energy projects in exchange for Senator Manchin's vote on the Democrats' major climate, health, and tax bill. That's the bill that was passed through the budget reconciliation process earlier this year. The Senate Thursday night also joining the House in passing a one-week extension of federal government funding, known as the CR, or Continuing Resolution, that will prevent a government shutdown midnight tonight and gives Congress until next Friday, December 23rd, to pass something longer term. This week, it was announced that a framework agreement for an omnibus spending bill to cover the full fiscal year has been agreed to by the top Democrat and Republican on the Senate Appropriations Committee and the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee. But the House Republicans are not on board, and some Senate Republicans also opposing it. Before the CR passed Thursday, Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, offering an amendment that would turn the one-week CR into a 3-month CR to move negotiations for the full fiscal year spending to the next Congress.
There seem to be people who want to make sure that all spending decisions are wrapped into one spending bill. Very often, those are wrapped together in one omnibus spending package and then held off until a day or two, sometimes just hours, before the government is set to shut down. That's when the magic happens. But it's not good magic, it's really bad magic. That's when these twin threats of sacrificing Christmas on the one hand or running into a government shutdown on the other hand, they operate like paired scissor blades to cut through what would otherwise be an insurmountable task. And that task involves convincing senators to vote for a bill 3,000 plus pages long, likely this year containing 7,500 or so earmarks, a bill that they have never seen, a bill that does not, as we speak right now, exist without ever having seen it. We all know that this is wrong. We all know that this is a corrupt way to run a government. This is a corrupt process that brings about all kinds of special interest giveaways. And in the absence of the light of day, they pass with the threat, the extortive threat of a government shutdown or canceling Christmas. Members end up voting for that which they know they have no business supporting. That's why my amendment is simple. My amendment simply gives us the flexibility to make these decisions not under duress, to make these decisions with clarity of mind and not influenced by this dual threat of a shutdown and cancellation of Christmas.
Senator Mike Lee on the Senate floor Thursday night. His amendment was opposed by Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, who chairs the Appropriations Committee.
Continuing this to March 10th imperils our national security, ignores the real pain and consequences of inflation. The full-year omnibus appropriations bill without that, the NDAA we passed this evening is a broken promise. The bipartisan PACT Act goes underfunded. VA and medical care falls at least $7.5 billion short. Some of my colleagues say we should do more on the southern border. Well, the proposal just made on this CR does nothing to help on that. It doesn't help on the fires, the floods, and all the rest we have. We have a bipartisan, bicameral framework in place. Let's have the courage to sit and vote it up or down. Don't keep kicking the can down the road. It helps no one. I urge my colleagues to reject the proposal.
Senator Patrick Leahy, Appropriations Committee Chair, on the Senate floor Thursday night. Senator Lee's amendment to change the end date of the short-term government funding bill, the CR, from next Friday, December 23rd, to March of next year, was defeated by a vote of 35 to 56. 7 Republicans joined all Democrats in voting no, one of those Republicans, the minority leader Mitch McConnell. The Senate then went on to pass the one-week government funding extension. That vote was 71-19. On Wall Street, the Dow down 281, S&P down 43, NASDAQ down 105. The president of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, Mary Daly, said in a CNBC interview today that she expects the central bank to raise interest rates at least another percentage point, and maybe more, before it can stop to see how the increases so far are affecting the fight against high inflation. She said the range is probably 4.75% to 5.25%. That's up from the current target range of 3.75% to 4%. Mary Daly was later interviewed today by the American Enterprise Institute, C-SPAN covering that event, and she was asked how she and the other Federal Reserve Board members would know when to stop.
Do you wait for the unemployment rate to hit a certain level and that tells you to stop? Or do you think to yourself, we've done a lot of tightening and we need to sit back and see whether the unemployment rate hits a level that we deem too high?
So here's how I think about it. I think about it as we have to, and we put this in our FOMC statement in the November meeting, and we still have it still in there in December because this is how it works, right? We already have done a lot of tightening, cumulative tightening of monetary policy. So that's already in the pipeline, and we have more planned. So that's in the pipeline. Then we understand that monetary policy acts with a lag. We don't know how long those lags are, which is why the third part of that statement is so important that we put out, which is we will continue to watch the evolution of the economic and financial data. So we know there are lags, which means we can't wait till inflation gets to 2% before we stop tightening or stop raising rates. I mean, that would be the kind of unforced error that causes over-tightening. We have to account for the lags, but we don't know what they are. Looking ahead, we have to watch the data to see where they are. So it's really experiential learning and looking at the whole dashboard of indicators. So the ones I look at are not just the headline numbers for unemployment and inflation, but what's going on in the labor market? What do quits look like? What does job finding look like? What happens to vacancies? Are there help wanted signs? Just, you know, if you go out in your communities, are the help wanted signs coming down? And when you go to your favorite store, they have the normal hours you expect because they have full amounts of workers. That's a labor market sign. On the inflation side, you know, do I see sales starting to reemerge at retail outlets? Do I see the price of things? You know, there's a particular place I go for services for my haircut. They just keep crossing out the prices and writing in new ones. And when I see that stop happening, I'm like, okay, we're starting to get some relief on inflation. So there's a lot of published data we can look at, but this is where talking to people being out there, it's really where the 12 reserve banks, the regional feds, people often wonder, why do we have those? Well, here's a really important reason we have them. We have people all over the nation in these 12 reserve banks talking to people who run businesses, who have not profits, who are workers and unions, and asking them, what is it like out there? How's it going? What's happening? And that gives us the forward-looking information we need to ensure that we do our best at not over-tightening or under-tightening. That's how I make my decision.
Mary Daly, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, in an interview with the American Enterprise Institute. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. Members of Congress responding to Twitter owner Elon Musk suspending the accounts of several journalists Thursday night, including some from the New York Times, Washington Post, and CNN, because he says they shared location data, his location data, against Twitter guidelines. Congressman Richie Torres, Democrat from New York, tweeting, "Freedom of the press is protected by the rule of law, but endangered by the rule of Elon Musk." Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, with this tweet, "The same political activists in the press complaining about being banned for doxing and endangering Elon Musk's life also demanded that conservative Americans, President Trump, and my personal account be banned. They need to stop being political activists and just be press." The State Department's deputy spokesperson Vedant Patel asked about this.
I have a question on Elon Musk. He's getting backlash for having suspended Twitter, suspended several accounts of American journalists. What message do you think that sends to the world, that in the United States one would suppress journalist accounts?
So let me say a couple of things. First, social media companies make their own independent decisions about content moderation, and I'm not going to comment on their specific private actions. But what I will say is that this department's support for free speech and freedom of the press is well documented, and it is certainly difficult to square how these removals are consistent with promoting free exchange. But again, social media companies make their own independent decisions on content moderation, and I'm just not going to speak to those actions.
By the way, they suspended me without explanation.
Again, Saeed, our support for free speech and freedom of the press is well documented.
State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel at a briefing with reporters. The United Nations Undersecretary General for Global Communications, Melissa Fleming, saying she is deeply disturbed by the reports that journalists were being, as she puts it, arbitrarily suspended from Twitter. She said, media freedom is not a toy. A free press is the cornerstone of democratic societies and a key tool in the fight against harmful disinformation. A story from CNN. A federal judge in Texas has put on hold for now the Biden administration's most recent attempt to end the so-called Remain in Mexico program. The ruling marks a setback in President Biden's efforts to end the controversial Trump-era policy, which sends certain non-Mexican citizens who entered the U.S. back to Mexico instead of detaining them or releasing them into the U.S. while their immigration proceedings played out. In June, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 the Biden administration had the discretion to end the Remain in Mexico program, but the Supreme Court sent the case back to the lower court to consider whether the rollout of the October 2021 memo complied with the Administrative Procedure Act, which requires that agencies take certain procedural steps when implementing policy. That reporting from CNN. Immigration, one of the topics today in a program with Congresswoman-elect Monica de la Cruz, Republican from Texas, interviewed by Russ Contreras, justice and race reporter with Axios.
Right now around the world, Christians are celebrating the birth of Christ. If you look at Matthew, the Holy Family had to leave their home in Bethlehem to go down to Egypt. They became refugees. Right now, on Christmas, there are a number of refugees not too far from where you live on the border there. You are a Christian woman. You've read the Bible. You know it very well. How do you balance the need for compassion for the stranger with the need for laws? You are someone that supported the wall, but you also have said we need more immigration judges. How do you balance that with your beliefs and what you have to do as your fiduciary responsibility as a lawmaker?
Well, I can tell you this, as a mother of two children and a single mom at that, I understand how these mothers who are coming across, bringing their babies over here for the American dream. And I am compassionate to that. My heart really goes out to them all year round, but especially in this time of Christmas. And how I feel is that an open border is not compassionate legislation, because what an open border does is it gives the signal to people that they can come through the treacherous, very, very dangerous journey, not through a law-abiding way, but through the cartel, who we know takes advantage of women and children, very sadly, raping women and children along the way. And that's what I want to stop. I believe that we need to have laws in place where we honor these immigrants in their journey and their desire to be part of the American dream. And that's why, after I'm sworn in, I want to work in a bipartisan way for solutions for these immigrants to come in a compassionate and a way that honors them.
U.S. Representative-elect Monica de la Cruz, Republican from Texas. Wednesday, December 21st is the deadline that a court has set for the Biden administration to stop using authority under Title 42 to return migrants to Mexico. under the premise of a COVID-19 health emergency. The court found that to be unlawful. Department of Homeland Security estimates that once Title 42 is rescinded next week, 9,000 to 15,000 migrant crossings could occur each day. The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre was asked what preparations are being made.
Are you aware of this warning from DHS, and do you have an estimate of how many people you're expecting will try and cross the border when Title 42 goes
away? Look, I don't have an estimate to share with you. What I can tell you is that the Department of Homeland Security has put out a six-point plan. As you all know, Secretary Mayorkas was at the border just recently to talk about this plan, put out a statement. And so we are focused. We are focused and we are prepared. We will have more to share in the next coming days on this piece. But again, we have done the work from this administration by securing record funding, and we are asking Congress to act. We are not asking for political stunts. We continue to see political stunts from many Republicans out there, and that's not how we're going to fix this issue. They want to secure the border. We've been doing that work on our own. And we're asking them to, hey, you know what? There's an immigration reform plan that the president put out on the first day. They should work with us and do this in a bipartisan way.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre at her news conference with reporters at the White House on Thursday. This week was the final Prime Minister's question time in the British House of Commons for the year, a year that has seen quite a bit of political turmoil in the United Kingdom. This was the question on Wednesday from Angela Eagle, Member of Parliament for the Opposition Labour Party, to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak of the Conservative Party.
Dame Angela Eagle.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. This year the Tory party has given us 5 education secretaries, 4 chancellors, 3 prime ministers, 2 leadership coups. And Mr. Speaker, the Partridge has had to sell the pear tree to pay the gas.
Very good.
So, Mr. Speaker, isn't it the case that after a year of Tory chaos, incompetence and self-indulgence, the best Christmas present the Prime Minister could give to the British people is a general election?
Mr. Speaker, they're happier with that than before, Mr. Speaker. But all I'd say, when it comes to what the British people need this Christmas, Mr. Speaker, in order to ease the disruption on their lives, the best thing that the party opposite could do is tell their union bosses to call off these damaging strikes.
British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, the final Prime Minister's question time of the year in the House of Commons. For a closer look at the year in British politics, joining us on the phone now from London is C-SPAN's Parliament producer, Peter Knowles. Thank you so much for being here again. Have you ever seen a year like this?
No, and no one has. Quite unprecedented to have 3 prime ministers in such short succession. And some records broken. Liz Truss, her record of 49 days as a prime minister, that's going to take some beating in future. It's way shortest of any prime minister so far. But she succeeded Boris Johnson, who'd only managed 3 years, which isn't particularly long. It has to be said, Rishi Sunak, at Prime Minister's Questions, the last one of the year, he hit 50 days. So he's already 1 day past Liz Truss's record. And there has been a sense of chaos in government, especially in September, October. But it's settling down. Rishi Sunak exudes calm and a fair degree of good humour, actually. And there is a sense that things have calmed down, but the list of problems, really big problems, that the government faces, it hasn't shrunk at all. The government faces a heap of trouble in the next few weeks and the next few months.
What issues are dominating the agenda?
The immediate one is strikes in the public sector. That's the nurses in the health service going on strike. They have done it before in the past, but a long time ago. It's very rare, and this is a big strike. And we have apparently endless strikes on the railways. the postal workers, and others besides. So that's a really dominating issue, and that dominated the exchanges between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition Labour Party, with the Keir Starmer trying to portray this as entirely a problem made by the government and its mishandling of the economy, and in return, Sunak and the Conservatives arguing that that Labour don't know what they would do in response to the trade unions, and point to the very close links between the trade unions and the Labour Party itself. So those are two. So that's one really big issue. The others, briefly, the economy in general, that's inflation running over 10%, public finances in a poor state, illegal migration across the channel at a rate we've across the channel between England and France at a rate we've never seen before, and tragically some more deaths at sea in the last few hours. Planning reform, which is a really, really sore, difficult issue for the governing Conservative Party. And then the aftermath of Brexit in terms of some acute difficulties over Northern Ireland. And a question that's now posed by Scottish nationalists, which is this a voluntary union now that the courts have ruled that the Scottish Parliament cannot go it alone and declare another referendum? So the question that they ask is this a voluntary union? And if it is, how does Scotland exit from it? So that's quite a heap of trouble, actually. And that's most of that's not going to go away quickly. And people look ahead to the possibility of a Labour government, maybe 2 years down the line, and think that, well, most of those problems will still be around, and it may be that Labour has to answer those issues. At the moment, it's down to the Conservatives.
You had a chance to meet the new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. How did that go?
Well, it was good fun. This was in a lobby reception in Downing Street, in the very glamorous rooms of Downing Street, underneath some pretty impressive original artwork. And Rishi Sunak told me that when he worked in the States, he was a keen C-SPAN viewer. So that was something I thought might be nice to share with yourself, Michael. And he was chatting to journalists from the lobby and seemed very comfortable in those surroundings, and doesn't look the least bit frightened of talking to journalists, not at all.
We're talking with C-SPAN's Parliament producer Peter Knowles in London. The new Prime Minister will be facing senior members of Parliament next week for the first time in the Liaison Committee. What issues are expected to come up there, and how is that different from Prime Minister's questions?
The issues this next week are going to be mainly around foreign affairs and international relations and Ukraine. The difference in style with Prime Minister's questions is quite important. In Prime Minister's questions, only the Leader of the Opposition and the Leader of the Third Party, at the moment that's the Scottish Nationalists, the SNP, only they get to ask a follow-up question or follow-up questions. So it's relatively easy to deal with people who you can give one answer to that's maybe not a great answer, because you're then on to the next question. So that's the format for Prime Minister's questions. We come to this committee, which is rather strangely called the Liaison Committee, and it's a group of all the senior committee chairs, and they're all of them allowed to ask follow-ups. So it has much more potential to be difficult for the person answering the questions. The only Prime Minister I've seen who looked like they really actually enjoyed being there at this committee was Tony Blair. Since then, people have looked like they were quite glad when it usually runs for 2 hours, when those 2 hours were over, because they get a grilling that of a kind that's quite different from Prime Minister's questions.
On another issue regarding the British government, but not the Parliament, there's a documentary that's making some waves here in the U.S. with Harry and Meghan. How is that playing in the U.K.?
Yeah, That's an interesting one. A lot of people have watched it. Far more people haven't watched it, but it's talked about everywhere in the newspapers. It divides opinion. Some recent opinion polling that was done with a reasonable-sized sample suggested that there was quite a hefty proportion of the public don't like Harry and Meghan's story, are not appreciative of them telling it. Well, they might think, well, that's because they've been led in a certain direction by the popular press in the UK. The royal families, the working royal families' response to this has been to say nothing, to get on with being out and about in public, doing the kind of things that they do. So within an hour or two of Prime Minister's questions, the King Charles III, he was in Parliament visiting Westminster Hall for the unveiling of a plaque remembering the lying in state of his mother, the late Queen Elizabeth, and unveiling a gift from parliamentarians to the late Queen, marking her 70 years on the throne. So the working royal family are just getting on with it and seeing if it works to say nothing. And so that's how things stand. But sure, when you talk to people, people do take sides. Many conversations in pubs and elsewhere are people jumping to one side or the other, the Sussexes or the Waleses. It's going to be a topic right through Christmas and beyond, I'm sure.
Peter Knowles is C-SPAN's Parliament producer joining us from London. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can listen to the final Prime Minister's Question Time from the British House of Commons in London, replayed Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN Radio. Various news reports today that President Joe Biden plans to name former Congressman Joe Kennedy III, Democrat from Massachusetts, as special envoy to Northern Ireland. That post has been vacant since January 2021, when Mick Mulvaney stepped down at the end of the Trump administration. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word to get the stories being talked about in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.